Hi, I'm Scott Jones. I'm director of the Electronic Frontiers Forums track at DragonCon. This talk is XMRV, CFS, and the Internet, how patient communities are changing medicine. The question of the XMRV controversy is not just academic for me. My father was diagnosed with chronic fatigue syndrome back in the 80s, and then I myself was diagnosed with chronic fatigue syndrome around 2005. So I followed this with great interest, the controversy itself, and also how the patient communities are reacting to it. So I'd like to introduce Dr. John Smarr.
Thank you very much. I'm the type of person who likes to wander around, which is then, since they're recording, I get to have a mic too, so I'm double-fisting it, as it were, different than what people were doing in the bar last night. So my name is John Smarr. I'm a physician in the Baltimore area. I have my time split between two things. I practice clinical infectious diseases at Sinai Hospital of Baltimore, and then the other half of what I do is I teach medical students and residents and help run one of the Johns Hopkins Internal Medicine residency programs. As a part of all of that as well, I run the evidence-based medicine course that we teach to all of our residents and try to get them trained on how they should be approaching the medical literature. And since that's kind of crucial to how patient communities sort of have reacted to things like chronic fatigue syndrome, we're going to spend some time talking about that. My goal is not to go through a very detailed breakdown of lots of science about, say, some of the theories behind chronic fatigue syndrome, but it's to address some of these other things. And hopefully we'll have some time at the end for any particular questions if I don't get to anything that people want to see. So, as always, one of the other things that I do is I'm the head of our continuing medical education committee in our hospital system, and so I'm very paramilitary about making sure all of our speakers, including me, say if we have any conflicts of interest or anything to disclose. And this is my opportunity to make an extremely bad pun, and this is a new audience for this. When it comes to disclosures, I have none. And if it was brighter, you would see the better picture of the nun, sorry. Disclaimer, as I mentioned, I'm affiliated. Sinai Hospital in Baltimore pays me money for my job, and I do educational stuff with Johns Hopkins. Everything I'm saying here is just from me and has nothing to do with those two institutions. With that out of the way, why this is important in terms of a topic. So this was actually a news headline from a few days ago, and I'm going to read you the article that I saw that came up. This was in The Guardian in UK, and the title of the article was Chronic Fatigue Syndrome Researchers Face Death Threats from Militants. And I'm going to read this to you just because it's interesting, and it's very clear that the reporter who wrote the article is biased towards the physician and scientist side of things. And I'm not complaining about that, but when you see the language, it's one of these things that I'm very critical of the media and how it reports anything, either pro or going one way or the other. And so the language they use just absolutely fascinates me. So it says, the full extent of the campaign of intimidation, attacks, and death threats made against scientists by activists who claim researchers are suppressing the real cause of chronic fatigue syndrome is revealed today by The Observer. According to police, the militants are now considered to be as dangerous and uncompromising as animal rights extremists. One researcher told The Observer that a woman protester who had turned up at one of his lectures was found to be carrying a knife. Another scientist, of course I have to read this dramatically too. Another scientist had to abandon a collaboration with American doctors after being told she risked being shot, while another was punched in the street. I don't know where the street is on the party. All said that they had received death threats and vitriolic abuse. I love that word. In addition, activists who attack scientists who suggest the syndrome has any kind of psychological association have bombarded researchers with freedom of information requests, made rounds of complaints to university ethical committees about scientists' behavior, and sent letters falsely alleging that individual scientists are in the pay of drug and insurance companies. I published a study which these extremists did not like and was subjugated to a staggering volley of horrible abuse, said Professor Myrla McClure, head of infectious diseases at the Imperial College in London. One man wrote he was having pleasure imagining that he was watching me drown. He sent that to me every day for months. And the rest of the article, which I won't finish up, is sort of in the same tenor about that. I thought that was very interesting because this was on the front page of the society culture area on the Observer last week, and so this is something that, that at least made major lay press headlines in that setting. So that's one. That's a good example of why this is important, because sometimes involvement from patient groups can, right or wrong, lead to situations like this. And despite the tone that the article uses, these are things that, that have actually happened in terms of events and physicians and scientists being threatened in this way. So my agenda is just to talk a little bit about the concept behind online patient advocacy groups, the effects on my own practice in terms of how I've dealt with seeing patients, the importance of the public interacting with the medical literature, because that's very important. And then we'll talk a little bit about XMRV and CFS as a case study about how all of this can come about. So a little bit about the concept of online patient advocacy groups, which of course did not exist until we had an online, and especially now that it's far easier for people to have access. With, as we all know, the function of the internet, or one of them, is to bring, as opposed to the other function being porn, is to bring together communities of people who otherwise would not be able to communicate, and so you can have geographically disparate people, much like those of us coming to a convention once a year when you see all of your friends and people that you know. You can stay in online communities as well. The basis for these cropping up for patients is multiple things, which are all very obvious, things like their shared experience in terms of disease or medical issues, the need for getting specific education or support. So, for instance, you could have a community that grows up around diabetes, because that way things like making sure that you're staying on top of each other to check your blood sugar and eat right and do all the things that you should be doing. And then there are some conditions in which these work for patient rights in terms of legislation for certain things, getting access to care. And something else that I was reminded of when I was talking with someone before was the fact that there are, one of the other functions of online patient communities is actually to try to figure out who's a good doctor. And if you, many of you may have seen that there are several websites out there that allow patients to rate doctors in terms of their customer service experience, like Health Grades is probably the one that people are familiar with the most. I tend to detest those sites, not because of bad things that are said, but the problem is that it was sort of a boom market in this online subcommunity, that there were companies that thought that this will be great, this is something that patients are going to flock to be able to rate their physician experiences. And it turned out that the only, most of the people who end up going on those sites to do it are people who have had very bad experiences with their doctors. And so if you, and I know about these because I have Google Alerts set up for my name, especially easy because my name is somewhat unique. There are very few of us. And so I get to see it whenever these things post. I've never had anyone post an actual review of me online, for better or worse, but I've seen my profile pop up on some of these sites. And so that's another way that patients can come online and have a group for advocacy. So this sounds like a very promising thing. It sounds like a very good thing. And so especially when we're getting into something like an issue with this XMRV and chronic fatigue syndrome topic, a good question is, how could such a group possibly, from a physician standpoint, be a negative thing? And there are actually several reasons that they could be. Especially when you're dealing with the second thing here, one thing that pulls people together in community is especially if they have a strong commonality. So people who have a diagnosis that some might consider controversial, which I think is a fair statement to say about chronic fatigue syndrome. It exists. It's real. There are some doctors who still do not believe that as a clinical entity that it actually exists. Separately, when people like that are going to see physicians, and especially physicians who have different opinions and may not have a certain level of training, or they may react negatively to the patients, you can have a population of people who feels very marginalized by this experience. They feel like they've sort of been abandoned by, to use a phrase that I hate, mainstream healthcare. And so they go looking to each other for support. They go looking for alternative ways to seek out to help each other and help treat their legitimate illness that they're experiencing. Another thing that can be negative is that there can be disputes over evidence for treatment options. In this case, XMRV being a virus that was at one point possibly linked to chronic fatigue syndrome and led to some people deciding, actually studying to see whether or not there were certain antiviral medications on the market that we could just give to people with chronic fatigue syndrome to see if that they would work. Another big point is the perpetuation of belief systems, and this is something I could talk about for hours in terms of how it interfaces with medicine. What I mean by this is that one of the biggest challenges I think that we have as physicians in dealing with patients is that oftentimes anyone who comes to see, and all of us, myself included, when I go to see my doctor, I have my own beliefs about my body, how it works, what it means when I'm feeling this way, how my own health works, things like that. Much more broadly, people, of course, can have beliefs about certain disease states that they have. Sometimes when people buy into a belief like this XMRV is definitely associated with chronic fatigue syndrome, it becomes something that gives them hope, becomes something that really, really plugs into their emotional center. And especially with something like this, where CFS is so frustrating to have and so incredibly devastating to your way of life, the idea that it would just be a virus that you could possibly get a pill for that would treat is amazing. You're looking for a silver bullet that would take this away. And once that's sort of hooked out into a person, and then if a bunch of other evidence comes out and says that initial association was wrong, we know all our human minds are unfortunately very crappy. We're all subjective. We all have cognitive biases. And one of the interesting things that many of you, I'm sure, have heard is that there have been good psychological studies that show that if someone has a strong belief about something and is confronted with evidence that says that they are wrong, it actually reinforces their belief because it's a way of how their thought process works. And so that's what I mean by perpetuation of belief systems is sometimes in these online communities, they will, despite the fact, and I'll show a screenshot later of one of the web pages that I found, that even though now I think the state of the evidence is that XMRV actually has nothing to do with chronic fatigue syndrome, there are still the number one patient advocacy group on the first page of Google, when you Google chronic fatigue syndrome, still has a link on their front page about there's been association with XMRV, so click here for information. So there still is a perpetuation of this hope or this thing that people still want to believe, or some people still want to believe, might be associated with it. So in terms of my own practice, I love my job. I think infectious diseases is the coolest part of medicine, not only intellectually, but also from the standpoint of all the different horrible things that infections can do to you. And especially because we're finding more and more that so many infectious issues are cropping up in other diseases that were not formally thought to have anything to do with infectious diseases. There was a study that I saw last week that came out, and it was sort of a crappy study, but it was pointing at the idea that someone was looking at that in certain genetically susceptible populations, there may be patients who, if they get an infection with a certain virus, that gives them high blood pressure. And so that's fascinating to me. There is association with certain adenoviruses, especially in kids, that can attack the islet cells of your pancreas and could cause you to get diabetes from an infectious cause. And so this is neat. This is cool. These things are not at a point where I would ever try to treat them clinically because we aren't there in terms of our understanding, but that's really cool stuff. But simultaneously, I did not necessarily realize when I got into infectious diseases that it would also be the one subspecialty that gets the most, for lack of a better word, quacks. And I'm not using that to talk about chronic fatigue. I'm using that to talk about a lot of people who suddenly decide that they have symptoms and they've come to the belief that it's due to some sort of an infection. I don't see a lot of chronic fatigue in my practice, and something that's interesting about things like chronic fatigue or chronic Lyme disease or Morgellon syndrome is sometimes these are geographically isolated. They're not evenly spread across the entire population. And one thought about that is that there may be a group of core people who do have chronic fatigue syndrome. Then there are other people who sort of have heard about it and are associating their own symptoms with it, and so they decide that they have chronic fatigue syndrome, and so you can get sort of these population blooms of people who really do have it and people on top of that who sort of become convinced they have it without having it formally diagnosed, if that makes sense. In my region up in Baltimore, chronic Lyme disease is the big thing that I deal with that's kind of similar. again, this is something I could talk about for a long time, but essentially, if you've never heard of what chronic Lyme disease is, it's something that does not exist as far as we can tell in the medical evidence. What it refers to is the belief that there are some people who can get bit by a tick, get a Lyme disease infection, be treated appropriately with antibiotics, and they still have symptoms afterwards, which does happen in some people. But there are some people who believe that this is due to the persistence of the bacteria, that the bacteria wasn't actually taken out by the antibiotics, and it can last in your body for years and years and years. And so the appropriate way to treat those patients is to give them years and years and years of intravenous antibiotics, which the medical evidence doesn't support, which carries its own horrible risks, especially when you have a foreign body stuck in your in a big pipe that's pumping blood to the rest of your body. And there are so many issues with that it's a fascinating thing. And I bring this up because, in a way, this is a very real way that someone who has had this type of an experience with certain patient advocacy groups, when they come to see a physician, it ends up not being a productive encounter. I can tell within 5 minutes of having a new consult for someone with chronic fatigue syndrome or chronic Lyme disease whether or not it's worth our time to have, because usually there'll be certain keywords or things that they're saying that it's very clear that they want me to buy into a certain thing. They've already come in with a base of knowledge that often they've gotten from the internet, and they're looking for me to reinforce that. And if I disagree with them, then I don't know if any of you have had this experience before, but what happens to me very frequently is that patient will often start yelling at me and getting very, very angry and emotionally worked up. And honestly, that's not productive for either of us. And in those situations, I'm the type of person where I'll actually say, you know, I don't think we're 10 minutes into this visit. I'll offer to refund them their copay and strike it off the thing, because I don't want them to feel like that they're coming to me, to someone that disagrees with them and isn't going to give them medical care, and I'm still going to be an evil doctor and bill them for it, because I don't think that's the right thing to do. And I don't think it helps, and I'd like to believe that's establishing goodwill in some way with some of those patients. So the big things that we've dealt with this chronic Lyme disease thing are two things. One, for the several years ago, so the most recent professional guidelines for physicians to treat Lyme disease came out in 2006 from my professional society, the Infectious Diseases Society of America. In Connecticut, which is where the towns of Lyme and Old Lyme are, where Lyme disease was originally described as a epidemic of juvenile rheumatoid arthritis back in the late 70s, and there was an investigation, they found it was actually due to an infectious agent. There are very strong patient advocacy groups that are of the belief that chronic Lyme disease really exists. And so they convinced, for the first time in history of medicine, the Attorney General of Connecticut to sue a medical professional society to say that our guidelines, which say that you should limit your antibiotic use, you should do it appropriately, you should do it based on our scientific understanding, are wrong, and that we were in collusion with insurance companies to deny payment for patients who were receiving years and years of IV antibiotics. So it ended up being a multi-year thing where the IDSA wanted to quash it, and the thing was is that from when you look at the evidence, there's actually no real question that this the way that people believe that it exists, that it actually exists. So they formed a very large panel, which included people who are in the pro-chronic Lyme disease camp. There's actually another medical society, and it's interesting with this is that there are a lot of physicians, or not a lot, but there are a minority, but a vocal minority of physicians who do buy into the concept of chronic Lyme disease. And they actually got to sit on the panel. And what they did was they reviewed all the evidence that went into the guidelines that were made about how we should be treating Lyme disease, and they unanimously voted that the guidelines were correct at the end, which was a very interesting result, but it was this huge, very expensive lawsuit that went on for several years. The other thing that has resulted from this in the medical literature is there are now, and this has been since this lawsuit happened, we are now seeing disclaimers on journal articles that are publishing professional guidelines. So, disclaimer alert, I actually took this off a set of guidelines for treating MRSA, which came out in January. And this was not in any of these guidelines prior to the lawsuit. but it's this caveat of it is important to realize that guidelines cannot always account for individual variation among patients. They are not intended to supplant physician judgment with respect to particular patients or special clinical situations. The IDSA considers adherence to these guidelines to be voluntary, with the ultimate determination regarding their application to be made by the physician in light of each patient's individual circumstances, which is sort of a fancy way to state the obvious that this is the cookbook, but you just apply when you can to the patient. And the problem, and one of the reasons they're putting this on here, is that one of the bases, the false bases of the lawsuit, was that insurance companies would look at professional guidelines and just read those and say, if you're not doing this, then we're not going to pay you for it, which actually didn't really exist. But this has been an interesting development that now, not only on any infectious stuff that's published, but any new medical guidelines are having some sort of a disclaimer like this since this lawsuit happened. So when we're looking at patient advocacy groups and trying to tackle the process of how they get information or how the general public gets information about science, there are sort of two issues to consider. One is the nature of medical studies, and medical studies are kind of a mess, and we're going to go over that in a little bit, and how they are consumed by the lay public and how they are reported on by the lay media. That can generate a lot of disinformation. And in the context of a very frustrating condition like chronic fatigue syndrome, that can lead to a lot of things that people report with an inordinate amount of hope and sort of get expectations up and can sometimes cause problems as a result. So I want to go through quickly is a little bit of a perspective on how to approach the medical literature for people who have not been trained in dealing with it. Why it's so bloody important is that for everyone in this room, and I think everyone who's in existence, is that medical studies are both easy and hard. They're actually very easy to read. Now, if you haven't had statistics training, that's going to be confusing. If you haven't heard of or know about some of the medical stuff underlying it, that can also be a barrier to entry. But at the end of the day, reading a journal article should be something that any of us can be able to do, because when you see how journal articles are reported in the media, oftentimes then you go to the abstract of the journal article and you see a very different message than what the soundbite was in the headline. So you don't even necessarily need to read the whole thing. The other problem, and this is true for clinicians, especially those of us dealing with productivity insurance issues, trying to see patients as fast as possible because the hospital that pays our checks has productivity limits for all of us, which is sort of the nasty business side of medicine in the United States. Fortunately, I've been able to isolate myself, so that's not as much of a problem for me. But there's a massive number of studies that come out on a weekly basis. We're dealing with, as I said, decreased physician time and the superficial and sensational media coverage. This is a graph that someone had put up for over a span of time, which is a month. And down here are, let's say that we're looking at the specialty of infectious diseases. This is the number of journals that exist, so we'll say there's 19. And this is the percent of important articles that are going to come out over the course of that month. And to get 50% of the important articles, you would have to read 5 journals a month. But to actually get 100%, you're more likely to read 20. And I don't care how fast of a reader you are, how smart you are, and I have several physicians who try to do this, you can't do that. It is impossible. There's not enough time in the day to keep up, and that's why one of the colloquialisms I've heard is that keeping up with the medical literature is trying to sip from a fire hydrant. There's just so much coming at you. One of the other challenges with media reporting on medical studies, and this frustrates physician outreach for me, because I'm a big proponent that we as doctors, no matter what we're doing, should be able to cogently talk with just not even just our patients, but just lay public in a setting like this or other settings about how science works. There's a phrase that has been coined called science by press release, and this is something that the original XMRV study in 2009 was guilty of, namely that the study was unembargoed on a certain day. Earlier in that day, the authors of the study were interviewed by the media and were making very strong statements that perhaps were not supported by the data that they had. And that can lead to biased media coverage, and it can lead to incorrect conclusions about the study. Some other examples from the XMRV thing is anybody who's familiar with the whole false association with vaccines and autism knows that the original person who propagated that was a doctor named Andrew Wakefield. And his original Lancet article, which was retracted a year or two ago, when that came out, despite the fact that in hindsight it looks like the entire thing was fabricated, the conclusions of the article, when you read what was written, were relatively sober. They weren't necessarily bad conclusions. What the study was is he did colonoscopies on several small children, did biopsies of their colon, and found that these inclusion bodies in the material that they got that he said were related to measles, and he was also relating a bowel problem to autism as well, which also didn't make much sense beyond the fact that he's actually a gastroenterologist. But he did a press release on the day the article came out where he said definitively the MMR vaccine is related to autism, and so we should split them up, give them one at a time, give different ones. And the other interesting thing about that, of course, is that Wakefield had just purchased stock in a company that was going to make this new split up measles, mumps, and rubella vaccine. So he was set up, he was sort of doing a study that there's so much more. I mean, again, we could talk about that for a long time, but there was so much wrong with this. But the message is that his original Lancet article that was retracted, actually, when you read it, the conclusions aren't that bad based on what he's presenting. But his press release that got transmitted immediately via the media in the UK was full of ridiculousness. The other thing that's not in medicine, if you remember a few months ago, the whole arsenic utilizing bacteria thing, that NASA did a press release about that. And it turns out that when we go back to the studies, it wasn't that the bacteria, there's some debate about what was really going on, but it was not as neat as, oh, we just found this bacteria and it uses arsenic in its DNA. There was some thought that it may have been under the certain selective pressures that they did, or it was because they were forcing the bacteria to be stressed in these certain conditions, so it wasn't something that should have been happening naturally. But bottom line is that press release also sort of misstated in an exciting way what this discovery was. So sometimes, and I've talked with a couple of you in the audience about this before, and especially if any of you have bled over to the skeptic track just across the hall, there is a difference between a couple of phrases, evidence-based medicine and something called science-based medicine. Evidence-based medicine, I like to say, it's a little bit more than us just not making things up. Some people say, you know, we do studies, we don't make things up. That's not necessarily true. The term was coined in 1991, and the official definition from the people who coined it was the integration of best research evidence with clinical expertise and patient values and circumstances, which sounds like a big business boilerplate of text. But what it boils down to is you have a patient, they have a problem, you go to the medical literature, you figure out the answer to the problem, and then you figure out a specific way to apply it to that patient in a way that is going to work. And it's all about sort of this umbrella philosophy with how to approach the medical evidence and use that to treat people. And it speaks to sort of the core values of science, always capitalize science and say it that way. So EBM, the big thing about it is it has a hierarchy of evidence, meaning that not all studies are created equal. Most people probably heard of the randomized, double-blinded, placebo-controlled trial as being sort of one of the crown jewels of the type of a study that you can do, because hopefully most things are very well controlled for when you're comparing therapies or comparing tests. Just a little bit below that is the idea of a meta-analysis. When you take a bunch of different studies, you actually take the data, you dump them together, and you run statistics on it. The problem there is that, as some people say, meta-analysis, schmeta-analysis, garbage in, garbage out. If you do a meta-analysis on a bunch of crappy studies, you're going to end up with a crappy meta-analysis. There are plenty of other less rigorous trials, and certainly sort of on the bottom rung are things like case reports, anecdotes, surveys, things like that. There are different professional groups that have ways that they will grade how well the evidence is when they're trying to figure this out. That's probably not worthwhile to go through. People sometimes ask, well, what are the best, quote-unquote, best medical journals to read if you're trying to pay attention to it from the lay public? There is a magical formula called the impact factor, which essentially is a thing that is calculated, and it says that your journal's impact factor is the average of how many times any article that you publish is cited by other journal articles. So it's a popularity contest. So if your articles are cited the most, the assumption, which isn't necessarily true, is that you're publishing the best articles. So the top five internal medicine journals in the world based on this impact factor are ones that I'm sure you've all heard of: the New England Journal of Medicine, Lancet in the UK, the Journal of the American Medical Association, the Annals of Internal Medicine, and the British Medical Journal. I had discussed with a couple people yesterday, I made a comment about that evidence-based medicine as a philosophy, some people perceive that it has some weaknesses. And what I mean by that is that it is a methodology and it doesn't necessarily take into account something called prior plausibility, i.e., if you're doing a study on a thing, if you're doing a study on magic, you shouldn't get a positive result because it turns out, I mean, magic is magic and it doesn't work in the real world. And if you're looking at some things that are under the rubric of complementary alternative medicine, supposedly, oftentimes those are things that actually have no efficacious treatment, but via the complex thing that we sometimes refer to as the placebo effect, some people will undergo that experience and feel better because of it. Because of that, you can actually, because of the vagaries of statistics, do studies on things that should not work, and occasionally you'll get a positive result. And so a proponent of a thing that doesn't work would point to that positive study and say, according to evidence-based medicine, I did a randomized, double-blinded, placebo-controlled trial on homeopathy, and it seemed to show an effect, so that means homeopathy works. But that's not true. That doesn't prove that homeopathy works, because you would expect with how statistics works and with a lot of the vagaries involved that occasionally you're going to get a positive result where one doesn't exist. So the other thing that the proponents across the hall in the skeptic track, there's a newer phrase called science-based medicine that they talk about, which is essentially the idea that we should be doing studies on things that we know have a plot, like basic science, it's plausible, it could actually help somebody, and so that's what we should be focusing all of our research on. We shouldn't be doing evidence-based medicine to prove things that don't really have any plausibility in the first place. The other problem is that, like I said before, there are these different societies, there are these different journals, they have different grading systems for the quality of the evidence, and so these are confusing and inadequate, and it's hard to describe. And as I mentioned before, meta-analyses can be a very useful tool, but they're very difficult to do well or challenging to do well. I'm going to skip over this a little bit. I do want to mention, how most physicians approach medical articles. As I said, a lot of us don't have a lot of time to keep up on the medical literature. Usually what doctors do is that if they see their new, their latest edition of the New England Journal, they will read or they will skim the abstract. And if that looks interesting, then they will read or skim the article. Or if someone is doing research or taking good time, they will then go ahead and do deep reading of the article, meaning they'll read the entire thing. How journalists, in terms of people who report on the medical literature, often approach it, is they focus reporting on the things that what gets them the most exciting things. I've done a lot of interviews for the radio and for TV, and it's been interesting. I always have to police myself because it's always that one goofy thing I say that I didn't mean to say that's the 5 seconds that ends up on the evening news, and that's crazy, but that's the way it works because they like the exciting stuff. So they focus on out-of-context sound bites that fit the narrative that the journalist is trying to construct, which may be not what you were trying to say. They do focus on things that are likely to trigger a public fear reflex. And there's the whole journalistic thing of false balance, the idea that you have someone who's on the side, who's done the research on XMRV. Actually, I'm going to back off. My favorite example of that is it was from a British comedy sketch where they were talking about, so there's a newscaster and he's interviewing someone at NASA about the Hubble Space Telescope. But that's your opinion. And we're going to turn over here to Crazy Barry, who believes that there is no space, but there's a carpet in the sky, and we didn't actually launch the Hubble, we just Velcroed it to the carpet. So the whole idea that you have what is very likely the right opinion, but then journalism will then take a crazy person and focus enough time on that to balance out in a false way what are both sides of the story. There are many good journalists, and the good ones tend to limit these things in terms of the above. a lot of science journalists, especially if you're going to a site like New Scientist or Scientific American for their news stuff, that is generally of a much higher quality than you would find on, sounds redundant, like even Wired, but I was even going to say CNN, MSNBC, Fox, take your, they're all in my crosshairs because they all do wrong things. The other interesting thing is that many journalists view the mission of journalism as reporting, not education. The good example of that is I have a friend who works at the NIH who used to be friends with a journalist. And they were friends for something like 30 years. He was involved with HIV when the first that came on the scene. And at the point that he had an interview with his friend, we knew a lot about how HIV was transmitted. We knew that it wasn't transmitted by kissing or via utensils or all of those things. But after this interview, the reporter went out, interviewed some other people who were crazy people who firmly believed that HIV could be transmitted by sharing a straw on a Coke bottle, and he then cut it out. So he put in the article that had this other, that he interviewed the physician, he then put the soundbite in of, and some people believe that HIV can be transmitted this way. And so the physician confronted his journalist friend about this, and his friend said, it's not my job to educate people. I'm just reporting what people say, and I can report it however I want. And so it's kind of shocking, but it's interesting that, again, I would like to believe that news, that journalism is about education, but in some people's philosophy, that's not necessarily the case. So how do drug or device companies, which often pony up the money for a lot of our medical research, deal with medical articles? Most drug companies have a research and development department, which is where their science comes from. They also have a marketing department, and what we found recently is there are some companies, and this probably is far more widespread than we're aware, the marketing department makes up fake science studies in fancy ways to market drugs to physicians. So they tell the physicians that we want to compare your drug, such as, how many of you people remember Vioxx when that was on the market? Yeah, which is similar to Celebrex, and that was on and then off, and I believe it was pulled off in 2005 when I was a chief resident. So one of the, there is a study that was published about Vioxx where the stated goal of the study that the company sold it to the physicians to get them involved was, we're comparing it versus this other drug, but they weren't even collecting data from that. What they were doing is they were collecting physician prescribing data, and they were sort of proving to themselves that if we involve physicians in a study in this certain way, they will write more prescriptions for Vioxx. And it's one of the other weird truths about how these companies interface with us as docs is that we all have things like DEA numbers or NPI numbers, which are nationally available and are on logged in pharmacies, and drug companies can actually query them. And some drug companies will look up, say, my prescribing information, and let's say the Allegra folk don't think I've been prescribing as much Allegra. Apparently, I've been telling people to get over-the-counter Zyrtec and Claritin too much, so they will send Allegra reps to court me to try to spike my prescriptions of that. So a little bit of a tangent, but I think it's interesting, and it informs some of their tactics when it comes to the medical literature. How I deal with medical articles. I read the abstract conclusion first, and then if it's interesting or relevant, I then read the other stuff, which is the stuff that people skip over. Financial affiliations, where the money is coming from, conflicts of interest that the authors have. And then once I've done that, I will read the whole abstract and try to look at it with a skeptical eye. Are there any signs of bias? Interestingly enough, often the conclusion that they write in the abstract of the article isn't supported by what they, it's not that they say the opposite thing, it's one example is Pfizer was comparing two doses of one of their antifungal medications to see which one worked better, and they both worked the same. The conclusion of the article did not say we compared these and they both work the same so you can use the lower dose because it has less side effects and is cheaper. Their conclusion was, this is a great drug. And I'm not kidding, that's what it said. Which maybe it is, but it again, the thing that they actually wrote doesn't match what the study was that was done. And if you didn't read more into the study, you might have come to a different conclusion of that. One question is, why do good journalists publish, good journals publish crappy studies, which does occasionally happen? The most interesting recent example of this was a study published a month ago in the New England Journal of Medicine that was comparing people people who had mild to moderate asthma, they stopped their regular medications, and then they either restarted them on an inhaler, albuterol inhaler for their asthma, or a placebo inhaler, didn't have anything in it, or gave them sham acupuncture, not even real acupuncture, but fake acupuncture, or nothing. And the results, it was an awesome study and it was a horrible study at the same time. It was awesome because it was a proof of concept of looking at this thing called the placebo effect. So when they did a test to measure how well people's lungs were doing, only the albuterol worked, which is what everyone would expect. Everything else, it was the other three things were equivalent to them have gotten nothing. When they gave them surveys about how much better they felt after the treatment, the albuterol, the fake acupuncture, and the fake inhaler all made people feel exactly the same amount of better, subjectively. But it was, so we could say that there are these patients who are saying they feel great, but their lungs still suck. So the lesson to those of us reading the article, or at least what I would have derived, is so that means that you can't actually, it's less reliable to ask an asthmatic person how they're feeling as a marker of how severe their asthma attack might be. The people who published the study, most of whom weren't physicians, there were 8 authors, only 2 of them were physicians. One of them went to China 5 years ago and got a doctor of oriental medicine, then went to Harvard and founded the Institute for Placebo Studies. They swung it that since the placebos make people feel better, that's a powerful thing, and so we shouldn't really, and I'm not really exaggerating when they said, we shouldn't really worry about how the patient's lungs are doing because our goal as doctors is to make people feel better.
Right.
And it makes absolutely no sense, and it seems like an unethical conclusion, but that's what the entire discussion of the article was about. So that was a crappy study. Why do journals publish crappy studies, and then why do journalists get to report on those badly sometimes to us? Sometimes it's because the topic is deemed as important. Sometimes they just lack it just slips through despite the fact it's a peer-reviewed process. And interestingly enough, journals, and this gets into something that we'll touch on later with regards to sort of EFF track stuff, is that they get reprint rights from drug and device companies. So when a drug rep comes to my office and they've got this hot new study about their new cholesterol-lowering medication, and they bring in 100 copies of the study to pass out to a bunch of doctors, they paid the New England Journal of Medicine $30 for each of those copies. So that's actually a business thing for medical journals. If they know that they're going to be able to get people to buy the study, sometimes they'll go ahead and publish it. So some of the issues that confront the medical literature are much of the money and things to be studied are supplied by biased sources. If you get money from the NIH, that's usually sort of the purest thing you can get. If it's coming from a foundation, if it's coming from the government, ignoring some people's opinion of the government, if it's coming from that, the people behind the money don't have an agenda. They just want you to do science. If it's coming from a drug or device company or from something else specific, they usually have an agenda behind, we're giving you this money to do this study because we kind of would like it to show this particular thing. The other thing is that authors are human, and they often make mistakes, as was in the case of the 2009 Science XMRV study. And the thing that we can't control for is sometimes people either accidentally say something or they're just blatantly lying in terms of what they're putting out there, and sometimes that doesn't get discovered for years later. Other issues include public education about study results is primarily done by the media, sometimes badly. I think I just fell in love with this phrase. Snake oil salesmen co-opting the weak spots of EBM to sell their magic beans. There's this non-standardization of how you deal with evidence-based medicine depending on what you're coming from. And there are sometimes non-standardized reporting mechanisms for how journal articles get retracted from the medical literature once they're out there, which is sort of a fascinating thing to talk about, especially now that we have more and more journal articles being stored online. From a digital standpoint, more of the purview of this track, one thing is subscription and paywall access. And so when I'm sitting here advocating that if you guys have a question about a study you see, you should go try to track it down, oftentimes if you don't have a subscription to the journal, you would have to pay $30 to get that article or go through a library. Some journals will deem articles very appropriate and just have them freely accessible online. Then, of course, we had the what some of you may be familiar with. A few years ago, we had established the Public Library of Science One journal, which is a peer-reviewed Creative Commons open-accessed journal, which on the impact factor of that scale I showed you before, it's actually at 7 or 8. And so it's very well used, and it is reasonably well regarded. So things that are published in there, it's very easy for the public to get this medical literature. Something else I think is interesting is how they deal with you being able to access back issues. The New England Journal of Medicine, when they revamped their website 1.5 years ago, put all their back issues online, and oftentimes they were available for free. And this is crazy stuff from back in 1892. I have a journal article I downloaded about injecting silver into somebody's thorax to treat their pneumonia. It's just spectacular to sort of read about. Now, last month they decided, as a profit thing, they said, okay, we're locking down all issues prior to 1930. So you now have to pay extra to be able to get those, whereas those were free to access before for business things. I obviously disagree with that because that seems somewhat ridiculous. One new thing, of course, is content delivery via RSS feeds. I actually don't subscribe to any paper journals. One of my folders in my Google Reader is just for all the journals that I access. And I can actually, sometimes some of my subscriptions are cheaper if I'm just getting the online version. So that is something that's being very efficient, and especially with my smartphone, I can now, if I've got a journal article I want to read and I'm stuck in an elevator on the Hyatt and I've got 5 minutes, I can actually pull it up on my phone and look at it that way. So I've been babbling for a while. Let's get to chronic fatigue syndrome as a case study for a lot of these issues that we've been generally talking about. So chronic fatigue syndrome is a prototype medical condition for considering how public advocacy groups can affect how medicine is delivered from physicians and from other people. One truth about it, and the reasons why it's prototypic, one thing is that there's an uncertain prevalence because different people have different case definitions for what CFS is. There are some estimates that say that maybe 1 million people in the U.S. have it, maybe 250,000 people in the U.K. have it. It is a subjective syndrome primarily in terms of symptoms versus having objective things that I can look and see on the physical exam, for instance. There's not like a hot swollen knee. I don't hear crackles when I listen to the lung. There aren't these objective findings so much. It's mainly sort of subjectively how you feel. And there's poor clinical consensus, as I mentioned before, among physicians, some of whom still don't believe that it's a true syndrome. And because of all of this, these are the type of things that have led to the formation of CFS patient advocacy groups. This is the 1994 CDC case definition of how you get chronic fatigue syndrome. Again, this is a syndrome, so it's a collection of symptoms. There's no test that we can do, no objective blood test or radiographic picture we can take to prove that you have it. You need to have two things. One is that you have to have severe chronic fatigue for at least 6 months or longer, that is not relieved by rest, isn't due to anything else, and so when you're truly diagnosing it medically, you have to rule out absolutely everything else before you give someone that diagnosis that could be causing that fatigue and other symptoms. And you have to have 4 or more of the following, which is one of the classic things of a syndrome, is usually there are very popular things that people have. And so people run statistics and say, okay, if they have at least 4 of these, then there's a high likelihood that they have this. But things like memory and cognitive impairment, results from that severely affecting your way of life, how you're living, your ability to go to work, your ability to even get out of bed. Frequent sore throats, tender lymph nodes, muscle pain, multi-joint pain, headaches, unrefreshed sleep, and extreme fatigue and malaise after you do a minimal amount of exertion. So that's essentially what we're looking at when we're looking at trying to classify people who have chronic fatigue syndrome. So a note about one of my least favorite phrases in medicine, which is, it's all in your head. And this is something that a lot of people with subjective symptoms, especially people with chronic fatigue syndrome, have probably heard from a physician at some point in their life. The problem with this phrase is that oftentimes people interpret it to mean that the person who's saying it is telling them that they are crazy, as opposed to the idea that it could be something, a neurochemical issue, And so it's a very confusing phrase to use, and so I totally try to shy away from it. And what's interesting is that if I'm talking with someone who has something like chronic Lyme disease or chronic fatigue syndrome, and I start suggesting, well, it's not due to a viral infection, then they're saying, oh, you're just saying it's all in my head. And I didn't use those words, but that tends to come out a lot. And so this is, I try to avoid this phrase for that reason. So, looking for online patient advocacy groups, most people will head to the Googles. So this is actually the search results for chronic fatigue syndrome that I got this morning, just as a screen capture. This is just to illustrate a couple of things. The first hit, and say what you want about Google, but at least in terms of priority of factual information, I think they've done a good job of how these sites are flagged in terms of their search results. So it goes to the PubMed NIH site is the first link. The CDC's site is the second link. Interestingly enough, Wikipedia is the third link, but you're going to get that with absolutely anything. The Mayo Clinic is fourth. WebMD, for whatever that is, which I always say that's a choose-your-own-adventure book where every story ends in cancer. That's next. Then you get this link, which is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 down, is the first patient advocacy group that comes up when you do this Google search. And then there's eMedicine, and when you go further down the page, then a second one comes up. So when I first typed it in, I typed it in wrong, and I thought this was an interesting result, so I wanted to show it. So I typed in chronic fatigue syndrome, and you can't see it up here, but I accidentally hit a space between the N and the D. So chronic fatigue syndrome. And that triggered, and only this, so then I tried doing different permutations, an ad at the top of the screen, one of the paid Google search results that says chronic fatigue syndrome treatment options, latest advances, chronicfatigue-info.com, trustworthy, current report. And there were even more ads along the sides. So this is what, when I click that link, this is what this was, and it's essentially someone trying to sell you a book. There's no information on this website that has any clinical relevance to you. And so I would say that in and of itself makes it a little bit inherently untrustworthy. This is the page from that first patient advocacy group that I saw. Seems to be very well put together. As I said down here, this is the link they say where they have a fair assessment of talking about this, but they say CFS has been linked to a family of murine leukemia virus-related viruses, including XMRV, but there is conflicting data. And again, I would dispute the conflicting data. I don't think there's a conflict. Update on studies and media coverage provides the latest news. Find other resources here. So that's something that patients who are coming to this site are going to be immediately drawn to if they have heard of XMRV to try to look at that. This is the second patient advocacy site. I love the fact that we still have GeoCities templates out there. And the last version was September 19th, 2001, which I suspect was of the HTML code. Again, this was actually on the first page of Google. That was one lower than what I showed you before. So just examples of the first two websites that I stumbled across as for patient advocacy groups. Very quickly about what XMRV is. XMRV is a xenotropic murine leukemia virus-related virus. It was discovered in 2006. It was initially linked to prostate cancer prior to being linked to chronic fatigue syndrome. And there were a couple of studies after the initial one on prostate cancer that seemed to show it. What they were doing is they were testing samples of biopsied prostate tissue, and they were doing PCR, and they were finding it to be positive when they did that. But since then, there have been a bunch of studies that have refuted the prostate cancer XMRV link, and including retesting some of the samples that were in those original studies. And some of what people think about why that's the case plays into the whole chronic fatigue syndrome issue. So with regards to CFS, this is the Lombardi's group, or the one in Science in 2009 that did this original article. What their results were that they came up with is they tested the serum, the blood, from 101 patients with chronic fatigue syndrome and found the presence of XMRV in 67% of those people. When they tested healthy controls, they only found it in 4%. And so they went, OMG, LOL, look at this. There's this association with the virus with this patient population. I don't think that's a valid statement to take from that data. It's interesting. It's very interesting and deserved to be followed up. But it doesn't prove anything with regards to it being the causal agent of the people's problems, especially given all the other viruses and things that are flowing around, some of which are uncharacterized. The stated rationale of why they were even looking at XMRV, when you read it and follow the footnotes in the intro, makes no sense. They just decided to do it. There wasn't anything prior to this that had led them to believe that maybe it would be associated with chronic fatigue syndrome. And again, they actually did a science by press release thing, as I mentioned before. They came out, they had a press release that very strongly was saying that based on this difference, we have found a very possible trigger for what could be causing chronic fatigue syndrome. Since then, there was one further study that sort of was set up similar to the first one that seemed to show positive results. But since then, there have been several that have been done that have been negative. Most recently, there was a very good one in the Journal of Infectious Diseases. And these included retesting prior samples, looking at things like the labs that the original studies were done on, comparing primers and other supplies they were using. And it really, really looks like that XMRV was a lab contaminant that has in those samples. And this actually happens far more frequently than some people realize in terms of doing these types of things, because again, this is murine, so this is from a mouse. Given how cell lines are taken from mice and the use of mice in labs and where primers are derived from, it's very common, if you don't have stringent lab controls, to have these contaminating things. And so sometimes that can contaminate your results. There's actually evidence now that the virus arose. The reason why it was discovered in 2006 is because it looks like it didn't exist before 2006, because it's a recombination of two other different viruses, virus pieces that aren't even pathogenic in mice and are non-infective in humans. And so that also supports the idea that, well, if it didn't exist before 2006, then how did it cause chronic fatigue syndrome and prostate cancer before 2006? So there is, bottom line is, from a conclusion standpoint, I don't think there's a significant evidence that proves that it's a human pathogen that has anything to do with chronic fatigue syndrome or prostate cancer. It didn't make sense to single it out to begin with. This is not 100% conclusive because this is science. It's an ongoing process. And if someone shows me excellent evidence that's definitely linked, I'm happy to change my mind. But at this point, it's very compelling evidence for that. And the prior probability of this causing this seems to be very low. Interestingly, the advocacy group reactions, despite the current state of the evidence, continue, as I noted before, to be proponents of XMRV as a causative agent. What this has led, and this has happened to me on two occasions, is patients coming in and pleading with me. And when I say pleading, I'm saying on their hands and knees crying, because again, this is a debilitating, horrible, horrible illness with a broad spectrum, to give them some sort of antiviral medicine for some length of time just to see if it will work. And it's all on the basis of the fact that this is still promulgated as being a possibility for the trigger. And then as the first news article I read a bit from in the beginning pointed out, it gives the there are some people who have the sense that that people who are doing good science are biased if they are not supporting the idea that XMRV is causative for chronic fatigue, even though science right now doesn't really say that it is. And this has gone from threatening legal action to splintering of physician groups, doing buy-ins with more so-called complementary and alternative medicine routes, and again, as we talked about before, hostility and not being open to physician opinion. A quick note on the idea of being open-minded. This is great. Sometimes I have patients who come in and I always know that the encounter is going to end badly when the first thing they say, and this has happened multiple times, is, I came to you because you seem like you're open-minded. And the thing that cracks me up about that is the reason why they think I'm open-minded is because I have a ponytail and I look like a hippie doctor. I'm not kidding. Because these people don't know me. They saw my picture. That's why they came to me. And it's challenging because when people like that say that, what they mean is being open-minded to the thing I believe in, as opposed to, I am open-minded, but when you go, if science is leading you in a certain direction, that's the direction you go. As some people would say, you don't be so open-minded that your brain falls out. So I guess the final sort of thing is, this is very challenging for physicians and for all of us to engage with internet patient groups like this. From my standpoint, the two things that we need to try to do, docs need to actively, patiently, and persistently try to engage with these groups, try to have better discussions of the medical literature with patients, and to get themselves, which is one of my missions in teaching residents, understanding the constraints of time and how evidence-based medicine works. The lay public, and I think that this is something that, should be part of an educational overhaul within the United States, is that we need to be taught more about how to deal with science, how to deal with medical studies, because obviously we all are going to have medical problems at some point in our life. We need to be skeptical about how the lay media reports on new studies. I've actually started saying, so I treat the lay media like Wikipedia now. It's a good place to look, but I will never cite it. I will go through the links to find other sources. And I encourage you all to do that. If you see a story that comes up on any news service, see if they cite the study it came from or what other sites, backtrack, look at multiple sources just to see if that reporter was spinning something or is there some truth to what they were saying. And again, despite the barriers, don't be intimidated about going to the primary literature. A few websites of note. My new favorite website, it just celebrated its one-year anniversary, is Retraction Watch, which is spectacular. It's a team of bloggers who actively seek out notices of journal articles, not just in medicine, but also in engineering, all the sciences that are being retracted, and try to track down why. Because all the scientific literature does a horrible job at being transparent as to when to retract articles and why they were retracted. And they try to actually seek out comments, and they actually have pissed off some high-name scientists and physicians because they're like, who are these stupid bloggers coming and questioning what I'm doing? But I think they have a spectacular mission, and they're doing excellent work, and they do talk about medical things when those come up. ScienceBasedMedicine.org is a spectacular website, and a lot of the skeptic track people are actually involved in that. There is a UK physician named Ben Goldacre who has a website called BadScience.net. The Center for Evidence-Based Medicine, CEBM.net, this is by a crusty, old, retired family practice physician in the United Kingdom who is absolutely hilarious and makes lots of bad puns when he's summarizing the medical literature for the week. And then the Cochrane Collaboration, this is the official worldwide evidence-based medicine group/gurus. I also have to put in a plug for the fact that at DragonCon, if you haven't seen the signs, we actually have a vaccine clinic down in, I have nothing to do with it, I'm just promoting it. Marriott 109, they're actually doing free HIV testing. They're giving out free Tdap shots, and supposedly they're giving out free influenza shots, even though the new batch of the vaccine isn't ready. Like, my hospital doesn't have it, so it would surprise me if we would have it early. But the interesting thing about the flu vaccine this year is it's identical to the flu vaccine last year, but you should still get the shot to help boost the immunity.
What's Tdap?
That is tetanus, diphtheria, and acellular pertussis. So it's sort of like you're a tetanus shot, except because whooping cough, which is pertussis, is now on the rise, and we found out we need to boost everybody's immunity with it. We've gotten rid of the tetanus shot as just a tetanus shot, and we've added in the other components to make sure it's protecting against multiple things. You should still get that every 10 years. That's my contact info, and I'm just over time. Excellent. Yeah, sure. So I have time to take a few questions if anyone has, or at least...
And please wait for the mic. But raise your hand if you'd like to ask a question.
First question, I guess I have a whole bunch of them. Can you diagnose Lyme disease by spinal tap?
No.
Thank you.
The it's actually, and I pause because it's more complex than that, but the PCR test that people do on spinal fluid is actually not FDA approved.
Okay.
The only FDA approved test is the just the basic antibody blood tests.
Which is very confusing,
and they suck.
Yes.
And that's the other thing. There are so many false positives and false negatives. It's very frustrating.
Yes.
Yeah.
Donating blood. I found my mother had found she went to donate blood and said, oh my gosh, there's a sign that says chronic fatigue syndrome people should not donate blood, and it's created in conversation with friends asking, well, can we get chronic fatigue syndrome from sharing a straw? Things like that now are starting, which is interesting. Do you find that to be a concern or agree? Or
I don't think it's a concern because it's generated from the concern that we're not entirely sure. Back when we were, say, a couple years ago and we thought that XMRV might actually be a significant human pathogen, we didn't know was it transmitted by blood. And it's still a huge controversy now. I personally don't think it's a concern. I actually don't know what the Red Cross's personal statement is...
Red Cross prohibits CFS.
Okay, gotcha. And they do that because they if in any sort of emerging possible emerging pathogen situation like West Nile and things like that, that as soon as they get something new, they will flag it and they'll be very conservative about taking that flag off.
Flu shots. I've been told not to get them for years because of concern of having flare-ups and so forth, and I'm not sure that's the right thing to do or not the right thing to do.
Right.
I'm curious to know your opinion.
My opinion is that I don't see a reason why you can't get a flu shot because there's nothing that I've seen that reliably ties that to anything that would be a flare.
Do you have any, with your patients' knowledge or experience, or have done reports on getting SSDI, being diagnosed with chronic fatigue syndrome and SSDI?
What is SSDI? I'm tired.
Social Security Disability.
Oh, okay. I have been asked. That is a challenging thing. The one person that I investigated that for, it turned out that there was, granted, there's the national level and then there's going through things at the state level, and I'm in Maryland and the healthcare system in Maryland is far messier than in the other 49 states. And the answer that I got was no. But I don't think that's the definitive word on it. And like I said, I think it's a valid condition, and so I think that would be a fair. Mm-hmm. I would go to bat for someone to get that done.
I'm getting SSDI.
Oh, okay, good.
And I think I'll let everybody else have it.
Oh, sure, that's fine.
You mentioned an article on asthma, the study.
Yeah.
Where can I get a copy of that?
If you, the easiest thing is if you go to the New England Journal. Now, the thing is, that actually, I think, is behind a paywall.
Okay.
So if you were to go through a library, especially affiliated with an academic institution.
So it's New England Journal of Medicine?
Yes, the New England Journal of Medicine, yeah. It was beginning of June, I think.
Yeah, I have asthma, and the one thing I've learned is I cannot trust how I feel. I have to get out a tester and test.
Well, that was one of the things that pissed me off about the articles. I've had asthma since I was 4, and it's the same type of a thing. Yeah. I think there was some, Scott, there was one lady in the back there.
I'm curious about how long does it take before something becomes an accepted thing by the medical community. So I'm talking specifically about complementary medicine. In the mid-70s, right, chiropractors were considered quacks. Now most insurance companies cover it. Acupuncture, massage. How long does it take before it becomes an accepted thing?
That is actually a complex question. Doctors tend to be very conservative old farts, and so we don't like new things. That's the easy way to go. Now, in terms of complementary and alternative medicine modalities, I clearly have strong opinions on. My strong opinions are that if things are tested and we have evidence that they work in a measurable way from a science standpoint, then I think that's a valid thing for us to pursue as physicians. Whether or not something is paid for by an insurance company has nothing to do actually with whether or not physicians will engage in that. So for instance, at my hospital, we have a very large physical medicine and rehabilitation department, and they do acupuncture and they do a bunch of other things. I think too, there are funky ways that people will classify complementary and alternative medicine. Like to me, I don't put massage in there because massage is a valid thing. It works. But people who are proponents of CAM, who want to, especially when they do surveys, they'll do things like even putting exercise along with medicine, saying it's a holistic intervention, and then they can include and say, well, 60% of the population is using complementary and alternative medicines because they include the 59% who are working out every few days. So it's interesting. So that's a very long question, but does that sort of give insight for you for what you're asking? Okay. Yeah.
Okay. Any other questions?
This is more for information for people because I've just gone through this and the difference between having a long-term care policy,
mm-hmm.
and that if you have a long-term care policy, which I had through my employer, is dramatically and significantly different than if you were to get it outside of the company and how they're governed. And I don't know if you've run into that with other patients, but one is governed by ERISA, which the law is so much different than if it's not. Mm-hmm. And
yeah.
the chances of actually getting them to pay is health. But sometimes they would eventually. So if anybody has that, that type of insurance, I would look into it further to protect yourself, more or less.
That's good to know. Excellent. Thank you, everyone. I appreciate it. Thanks for listening.